declared France our traditional and eternal enemy. Although looking at the president today, Algeria seems to be taking a step back to give France the chance to do the right thing. If it does, the two countries can advance their diplomatic relations. That is a condition set by Algeria. South Sudan's 10 hopeless years.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
It should have been a scene of jubilation. But July the 9th, 2021, was not the national day South Sudan would have expected 10 years ago when it separated from Sudan eventually by referendum. It is riddled with the aftermath of a civil war and war crimes and is living a humanitarian crisis so bad that a UNICEF chief called it a child rights crisis. Its president Salva Kiir did make a welcome promise on cessation anniversary 9th July.
On my part, I assure you that I will not return you back to war again. Let us all work together to recover the lost decade and put our country back to the path of development.
A pledge not to return the country to war because there has been a ceasefire since 2018. But the past foes have violated past truces, and progress on this latest revitalized deal has drifted, exacerbating mistrust between the pair. The pair being none other than the president and his deputy. In fact, they formed a political working twin set as a power-sharing deal to avoid rivalry and differences, which eventually did break out in 2013. The president is a former military commander from the Dinka ethnic group, and his deputy, Machar, is a rebel leader from the Nuer people. Abayomi Azikiwe is editor of the Pan-African Newswire. He has traveled extensively in Africa, conducting field research on political economy and history. He joins us from Detroit. Around just a year and a half after independence, this country was plunged into a brutal civil war at a cost of almost 400,000 lives. What was the reason behind this conflict?
The vice president, Riek Machar, in late 2013 was accused of attempting to stage a coup against the president. And they moved to arrest some elements within the ruling party as well as the military. And this, of course, set off, as you mentioned, a long, protracted struggle.
Observers have accused both the president and his deputy of playing a waiting game by delaying the full implementation of the peace accord, perhaps to evade accountability by, say, a war crimes court in partnership with the African Union. 2.27 to 4 million people were displaced by the war, and the country remains in the firm grip of political instability, economic malaise, and an acute hunger crisis. Sudan was the largest country on the African continent. Then a decade ago, it split in two to make for the world's youngest country, the Republic of South Sudan. After decades of fighting for independence, that day was a scene of jubilation, although you'd wonder why anyone would want to split his native land when complementary adjectives for a country are old, big, and rich. Well, South Sudan is rich in oil and other resources, and how many foreign lands of some clout wouldn't make a move for that? Under such circumstances, it's not difficult to tempt some domestic elements into not wanting to share their resources with the rest of the country. A UN panel of experts found evidence of well-established networks of arms suppliers in Eastern Europe and the Middle East, including from Israel, that are fueling the war in South Sudan. In a confidential report to the Security Council obtained by AFP, the panel described the arms deals as not recent and involving Israeli and Bulgarian firms. The Council has threatened to impose an arms embargo on South Sudan to try to end the fighting. Looking at reports that the Israeli regime violated UN sanctions and sold arms that have continued to fuel the Sudan conflict, what would you say are the Israeli interests in South Sudan's bloodshed?
This is down to undermine the struggle of the Palestinian people as well as the resistance forces throughout North Africa and West Asia. So their interest is to break up any type of solidarity with Palestine and other progressive resistance forces throughout the region, and also to exploit the oil resources and other resources in the Republic of South Sudan.
The international community has used the independence anniversary to urge South Sudan's leaders to do more to improve conditions for its under 12 million population. The journey from war to peace has been a long and difficult one, and there is still much to be done so that the people can exercise the democratic right they earned a decade ago. Nicholas Haysom said this. He's the head of the UN mission in South Sudan.
I think certainly for myself, I cannot think of anybody who deserves peace and prosperity more than the South Sudanese after decades of conflict. Durable peace and prosperity can only be made by the South Sudanese themselves. As we say in Africa, the doctor can't take medicine on behalf of the patient.
In the 10-year-old country, more than 8.5 million people face starvation. And 2.8 million children are out of school. That's the highest rate in the world. And it's due to limited access to education and high dropout rates. Schools closed due to corona have reopened, but of the additional 2 million pushed out because of corona closures, many have not returned. They must either work or study. Also, regarding the girls, most who dropped out are now mothers. Child marriage is a common problem in South Sudan. Rape and physical assault have also been reported among children.
When I was pregnant with my son, I got so sick that I had to go to Lir, a neighbouring village about 25 miles away, to get treatment. There was no means of transport, so I walked all the way and spent the night on the journey.
Such a waste to split your state basically because someone else wills you to do so, only to find yourself in a war in which forces are raping their own women. A wasted decade is how the South Sudan Council of Churches put it on the eve of Independence Day anniversary.
It was not only 2013, we had our colleagues, my brother, we were killed. Even during the struggle, my brothers, they were also killed.
Which other foreign countries might be interfering in this resource-rich country, and what are their objectives?
There's also the State of Israel, which had armed the SPLA, the Sudan People's Liberation Army, and also has strong diplomatic relations between the capital of Juba and Tel Aviv. These are two main international forces that have, of course, been supportive of the independence and the partition of Sudan. So there was an explicit effort to split the Republic of Sudan, and it was done based upon the legacy of British colonialism inside the country.
Given all the sacrifice made by the nation, President Kiir said the priority of the revitalized transitional government of national unity is the full implementation of the peace agreement, with a focus on security and reforms to the economy, which depends 98% on revenues from crude oil exports.
To offer him the best treatment, which was amputation. But we are not here for not amputation. We are here to save lives, to save limbs.
What are the prospects of peace in Sudan? Will the warring parties eventually agree to implement the peace deal?
If you're speaking of the Republic of Sudan in the north, there is a reconciliation process that's underway. It's very tenuous at this point, and there are a lot of variables that are involved. Still, you have the U.S., you have the State of Israel, you have Saudi Arabia, you have the United Arab Emirates. They're all attempting to influence the internal affairs of both the Republic of Sudan in the north, as well as the Republic of South Sudan in the south. And regard to the peace agreement in the south, it largely depends upon the discipline and the willingness to resolve these differences among the followers of Riek Machar and Salva Kiir, who have the two largest political blocs in the Republic of South Sudan. But Israel, as well as the United States, has to provide both Sudan and South Sudan with the political space that it needs to resolve their own internal differences.
Tribalism has been a challenge, and that's why the national dialogue has been initiated, said General Kwong, the spokesman for the South Sudanese Army. We now have become peacemakers in the region as we have mediated between the North and different rebel groups and the Sudanese government. Perhaps we'll know by our next show how they panned out for Juba, the South Sudan capital. Do join us again each week at the same times to see where the story led or to see what's new in Africa.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. The flood of guns from the United States into Mexico is helping to sustain much of the crime, violence, and corruption, driving thousands of Mexicans to seek a better life north of the border. We're prepared for an article written jointly by Robert Reich and Edward Helmore. The piece is titled, American Guns Are Flooding into Mexico and Wreaking Havoc. The article has been taken from the British newspaper The Guardian. Even as Republican members of U.S. Congress accuse President Joe Biden of failing to secure the nation's southern border, Mexico is facing a growing problem of securing its northern border. Guns from the United States are pouring into Mexico, arming violent drug gangs. Mexico has tried just about everything to stop the flow of firearms from the north, passing strict gun control laws, imposing stiff penalties on traffickers, and pleading with U.S. authorities to stop the trafficking. But nothing has worked. So now it's doing what any litigious American would do. It's suing. On Wednesday, 4th of August, Mexico announced that it is seeking at least $10 billion in compensation from 11 major U.S. gun manufacturers for the havoc the U.S. guns have wrought south of the border. The lawsuit charges America's gun makers know their products are being trafficked to Mexico and are expressly marketing their weapons to Mexican criminal gangs, designing guns to be easily modified to fire automatically and be readily transferable on the criminal market in Mexico. The deluge of firearms from the United States to Mexico, on average more than 500 every day, is contributing to mayhem there. Killings have become a routine part of the Mexican drug trade. In Mexico's recent midterm election campaign, 30 candidates were gunned down by criminal gangs. In 2019 alone, at least 17,000 homicides in Mexico were linked to trafficked weapons. Yet Mexico's lawsuit is likely to face tough going in the United States, where the easy accessibility of guns is also wreaking havoc, but where gun ownership is considered a constitutional right and gun purchases are skyrocketing. In addition, U.S. gun makers have erected a fortress of legal protections. In 2005, the gun lobby got congressional Republicans to enact the Protection of Lawful Commerce in Firearms Act, banning most lawsuits brought against gun manufacturers for marketing and distributing their products. At a more basic level, American capitalism considers any market to be an opportunity to make a profit. After all, a buck is a buck, or more precisely, 19.98 pesos at today's exchange rate. In the United States, buying and selling are hallmarks of freedom. To prohibit a sale is to intrude on the free market. For another government to bar its consumers from buying American goods is to violate free trade. Alejandro Celorio, a legal advisor to Mexico's foreign ministry, estimates the damage to the Mexican economy caused by trafficked guns totals 1.7% to 2% of Mexico's gross domestic product, GDP. What's left unsaid is that Mexico's illicit drug business is also a boon to the Mexican economy, adding billions of dollars each year in foreign sales, mostly to American consumers eager to buy thousands of kilos of methamphetamines, heroin, cocaine, and fentanyl each year. Freedom of contract, it's called. We sell them guns that kill them, they sell us drugs that kill us. But this isn't trading goods, it's trading bads. There's death on both sides. The merchants of such death, American gun makers like Glock, Smith & Wesson, Beretta USA, Barrett, Century International Arms, and Colt, Mexican producers of methamphetamines, heroin, and fentanyl, and the wholesalers and traffickers connecting buyers with sellers on both sides of the border are making piles of money. Free market ideologues will argue that as long as everyone is getting what they want, these trades are efficient. Yet vast numbers of people are dying. The U.S. Republicans who protect gun manufacturers and who are criticizing President Joe Biden for failing to secure the southern border from migrants desperate to come to the United States should take note of this tragic irony. The flood of guns from the United States into Mexico is helping to sustain much of the crime, violence, and corruption, driving thousands of Mexicans to seek a better life north of the border in the United States. It's also enabling the flow of dangerous drugs from Mexico across the border that are killing hundreds of thousands of Americans, many in states and congressional districts represented by those same Republicans. Guns, dangerous drugs, and desperate migrants are inextricably connected. The answer to solving one of these problems lies in responding to all three. Moreover, gun sales, which spiked sharply during the early months of the coronavirus pandemic, have continued to increase in the United States, with first-time buyers making up more than one-fifth of Americans who purchase guns. The development will frustrate and disappoint gun control advocates who point out the huge number of firearms already circulating in American society, as well as a seemingly never-ending cycle of mass shootings. A study by the General Social Survey, a public opinion poll conducted by a research center at the University of Chicago, 39% of American households own guns, up from 32% in 2016. Separately, research data compiled by the FBI's National Instant Criminal Background Check System, or NICS, background checks that topped 1 million a week in March of 2020, the highest since the government began tracking them in 1998, and continued with 1 week in April this year recording a record 1.2 million checks. Background checks are seen as a reliable metric to track gun sales. A third data study, compiled by Northeastern University and the Harvard Injury Control Research Center and seen by the New York Times, shows that 6.5% of American adults, or 17 million people in the United States, have purchased guns in the past year, up from 5.3% in 2019. Of those, almost one-fifth who bought guns last year were first-time gun owners, of whom half were women, a fifth were black, and a fifth were Hispanic. In 2021, gun owners overall were 63% male, 73% were white, 10% were black, and 12% were Hispanic. Separately, the Thrace, a nonpartisan group that tracks gun sales, estimates that 2.3 million guns were purchased in January of this year alone. The group said sales, which had remained largely flat for the duration of the Trump presidency, jumped 64% in 2020. Still, the increases are relatively small compared to the 400 million guns estimated to already be in circulation, including at least 4 million AR-15s, commonly described as assault rifles. South Los Angeles City Council Representative Marquise Harris-Dawson told the New York Times, "Americans are in an arms race with themselves," adding, "There was just as much a run on guns as on detergents and cleaners in the beginning of the pandemic." Increased gun sales comes as Texas recently became the 20th state to pass legislation that no longer requires a permit to carry a concealed handgun. At the same time, a rash of mass shootings, often involving AR-15 weapons, have dominated headlines. According to the Gun Violence Archive, 67 mass shootings have taken place in May of this year. The most recent occurred when a gunman opened fire in Miami, Florida, killing two people and injuring 20 others. Authorities in Texas said recently they had arrested a man accused of plotting to carry out a mass shooting at a Walmart store, and a search of the suspect's home turned up firearms, ammunition, and materials officials described as radical ideology paraphernalia. Still, researchers are wary of connecting increased gun ownership with gun violence. The FBI reported a 25% rise in homicides last year that has continued into this, with an 18% increase over the first 3 months of 2021 across 37 cities, including rises of 36% in the city of Los Angeles and 23% in New York City. But criminologist Richard Rosenfeld at the University of Missouri told the New York Times that the focus on gun numbers is misplaced. Richard Rosenfeld said, "The critical issue is not simply the increase in the supply of guns, but in the nature of the weaponry that's being used in violent crime. And that has really changed."
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, the Holy Quran is evergreen. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Someone asked Imam al-Rida alayhi salam, why does the Quran not get old by repeated study, recitation, and publication? Imam al-Rida alayhi salam said, God has not confined the holy book to a specific time or for a specific nation, and so it is new at all times and fresh for all nations. This is a very common question that gets raised today too by some Orientalists, by some progressive people, by the secular-minded people who really believe in obsoleteness of scriptures. So they say that, you know, Quran, you know, it came down 1400 years ago, and Prophet left, Ahlul Bayt came and they left. So why is it that you still insist Quran to be alive and of relevance, so to speak? Well, if you notice, Imam al-Rida alayhi salam, he answers that, right? This saying points to the reality that the Quran is not a product of the material world and man's transient and variable thoughts. So the dust of obsolescence does not cover it. It does not age with time. Rather, it has originated from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, who is all-knowing, and He is eternal. The more it is read, the more Quran is read, the more it reveals, the more relevant and interesting it becomes with the passage of time. This, in fact, is one of the signs of Quran's greatness and grandeur. You don't trust me? Give it a shot. Read the same chapter over and over again and see how it reveals itself to you. Welcome back to your listeners. Today we are talking and discussing about the Holy Quran. And there are some who say that Quran should be obsolete now because it was revealed, it was sent by Allah, hundreds of years ago, right? Over 14 centuries ago. So the relevance of Quran should have depreciated and deprecated, and hence it's obsolete, and hence it should be put on the side, right? This is some people out there who claim, even sometimes, you know, some quote-unquote progressive Muslims, they point to this or they allude to this. They sometimes don't say it openly, but in deep down in their hearts, they feel that, you know, okay, the times have changed, the world has changed, we have progressed, we have developed, there is technology, you know, we have went to space, we have done this, that. So Quran, you know, it's a good book, but it's an old book, right? So we tried to answer that before the break, that Quran is eternal. And this is one of the miracles of Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. And Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala revealed this book on the heart of Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, which is the book of guidance. Now, as soon as we say that it's a book of guidance, we have to understand that it is a source of guidance for humanity. So long as human beings exist, the Quran will continue to guide these human beings, right? It makes sense. It is a mercy of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that He revealed the Quran for our guidance. Otherwise, we would be lost. We would not know many things we know after reading and reciting Quran. Look around. Those who do not benefit from the Quran, they do not have access to the absolute truth and reality. And in the end, when they leave this world, they leave it in bewilderment. Thank you. dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
In the limelight.
A day after wind-driven flames from the Dixie Fire ripped through the Northern California town of Greensville, residents who had reluctantly left their homes behind sat at a picnic table under hazy skies in a parking lot about 25 miles away. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Livia Olbeck-Ripka and Annie Carril. The piece is titled, "We Lost Everything. Residents are left in shock by the Dixie Fire's destruction." A day after wind-driven flames from the Dixie Fire ripped through the Northern California town of Greenville, residents who had reluctantly left their homes behind sat at a picnic table under hazy skies in a parking lot about 25 miles away. "I knew our town was going up," said Teresa Clark, a 34-year-old, describing the moment she had decided to evacuate, watching the flames approach as the air got hotter and the chances for escaping grew slimmer. "That's when the sheriff pulled up and said, 'You guys need to leave,'" she said. "I was scared to death." Inside the nearby Paradise Grill Diner in Quincy, California, some Greenville residents spoke in disbelief about how quickly the flames had raged down the mountain towards their beloved community. "We lost everything," said Jose Garcia, a 34-year-old who sent his family away but stayed behind with his father, Juvenal Garcia, a 70-year-old, vainly chopping down trees to create firebreaks. "I tried to defend it to the last second," said the younger Mr. Garcia, who described realizing he had just minutes to get his three dogs in the truck and grab important family documents as the wildfire burnt closer and closer. "The fire just pushed me out," he said. The Garcias' houses were lost to the flames like so many other buildings in Greenville, a town of about 1,000 people that became but the latest California community to be devastated by wildfires that are growing faster and burning earlier in the season than anyone in the state has ever seen. "I don't think we'll rebuild," said Mr. Garcia, who also lost his taco restaurant. By Friday morning, 6th of August, the Dixie Fire, which sparked a little more than 3 weeks ago, had grown to nearly 433,000 acres of land, according to the authorities, becoming the third largest blaze in recorded California history, up from 6 the day before. It is now the largest wildfire in the United States this year, surpassing the Bootleg Fire in southern Oregon. Sheriff Todd Johns of Plumas County said at a community meeting on Thursday, 5th of August, that there were no reported injuries during Greenville's destruction, but that the authorities were still looking for four people who were unaccounted for. He estimated that the blaze had destroyed more than 100 homes in the area. "My heart is crushed by what has occurred there," said Sheriff Johns, a lifelong Greenville resident. Greenville's downtown had still had many buildings that dated back to the Gold Rush era of the mid-19th century. Fire officials estimated that 75% of the town's structures were lost to the blaze. It looks like a bomb went off, said Ryan Meacher, a 37-year-old whose father's house in Greenville was one of many that burned down. There is nothing left. Mr. Meacher said it was heartbreaking to think about what was lost. The library where he would pick up books and VHS tapes, the pizza place next door with an arcade. Also destroyed were a charter school and the Cy Hall Memorial Museum, which covered the history of Indian Valley, a verdant mountain valley whose inhabitants once depended on timber from the surrounding mountains, and where many residents still rely on cattle ranching. Jesse Isu, a 38-year-old, lives in nearby Taylorsville and evacuated south on Thursday with her husband, her three young children, and her parents, who did not know whether their Greenville home still stood. She said it had seemed like a movie as they prepared to leave with their Nigerian dwarf goats, an alarm blaring and wild wind sending a smoke plume with black center towards the area. Greenville is a wasteland, she said. It's just surreal. In the parking lot outside the Paradise Grill, other evacuees from towns near Greenville were camped out in trailers, waiting to see if their homes would suffer the same fate. Though she had lived through other wildfires, Sandy Paget, who had evacuated from North Arm, said this one was different. We didn't have this wind, she said, adding that it was driving the wildfire to the point of being unfightable. Sandy Paget said that, as far as she knew, her town and home were still untouched, though others had remained in the town she and her partner had chosen to evacuate, she said, because it was not worth the risk. There's a lot worse tragedies than losing your home, Sandy Paget said. You can always rebuild. Dixie Fire exploded by more than 97,000 acres in just 24 hours, becoming the third largest wildfire on record in California by Friday, 6th of August. It had been only 6th on the list of blazes the day before. The fire, which leveled the town of Greenville in Northern California this week, also became the largest blaze in the United States this year, having burnt 432,813 acres of land by Friday morning, according to the New York Times Wildfire Tracker. It has destroyed at least 91 structures so far and is likely to grow, with only 35% of the fire contained. The Bootleg Fire in Oregon had previously been the largest wildfire in the nation this year, at 413,765 acres. That fire is 87% contained. Experts say that the Dixie Fire's dramatic growth fits into a trend of rapidly expanding wildfires fueled by severe drought conditions, driven in part by a warming climate. The number of wildfires has not gone up, but the amount of burnt area since the 1980s in California has actually doubled, more than doubled, said Robert Field, a researcher at Columbia University and NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies. Fire season has also started earlier in recent years. The Dixie Fire ignited on 13th of July, about 2 weeks before the state typically experiences its most intense wildfires. We're approaching historical levels of wildfires that have not been seen at this explosive rate of growth in over 100 years, said Tim Jones, a public information officer for the agencies fighting the Dixie Fire. Seven of California's largest wildfires have occurred within the past year, the largest in the state's recorded history going back to 1932, because records before that are considered unreliable, burnt last August when a series of dry lightning strikes ignited multiple fires that merged to scorch over 1 million acres of land. there's just that much more fuel on the landscape, and it's become more flammable because of climate change, said Dr. Field. Fire experts don't see much indication that conditions would improve anytime soon. California is seeing larger and more intense wildfires, putting those on the front lines at greater risk as they attempt to stop raging flames like those from the Dixie Fire that ripped through Greenville, California this week. They're just spreading so fast and so hot, sometimes we feel like we're on our heels, trying to play catch-up, said Chris Aragon, a captain with California Fire, the state's fire agency. It's not the same behavior as the fires we were used to a decade or more ago. Of the 10 largest wildfires ever recorded in California, 6 were within the past 12 months. The Dixie Fire grew overnight to become the state's 3rd largest wildfire on record and the biggest so far this season. While most people flee from the flames, the approximately 7,500 firefighters at Cal Fire run towards them, sometimes inhaling smoky air, collapsing from dehydration, and working 96 hours straight. When Captain Aragon, a 36-year-old, worked as a seasonal firefighter more than a decade ago, most wildfires broke out between July and September, he said. The season was long if it ran through Halloween. The large swathes of the West dry out and burn, scientists say. Climate change is playing an increasing role in the earlier fire seasons, the deadly heat waves, and the lack of water. The record high temperatures that assaulted the Pacific Northwest in late June and early July, for instance, would have been all but impossible without climate change, according to a team of researchers who studied the deadly heat wave. Heat, drought, and fire are connected. And because human-caused emissions of heat-trapped gases have raised baseline temperatures nearly 2 degrees Fahrenheit on average since 1900, heat waves, including those in western United States and western Canada, are becoming hotter and more frequent. The Southwest is getting hammered by climate change harder than almost any other part of the country, apart from perhaps coastal cities, Jonathan Overpeck, a climate scientist at the University of Michigan, recently told the New York Times. Jonathan Overpeck added, "And as bad as it might seem today, this is about as good as it's going to get if we don't get global warming under control."
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Imam Khomeini guided the Iranian nation to determine their own fate. June 4, 2021. The televised speech delivered on June 4, 2021 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the 32nd demise anniversary of Imam Khomeini. Greetings be upon him. Imam believed that the authority of Islam and of the people would eliminate the problems of the country. Imam used to think that the two words, Republic and Islamic, would untie the knots in the problems of the country. He believed that the key to all the problems of the country lay in the implementation of Islam and the presence of the people at the scene. This was Imam's opinion. When he said the Islamic Republic, not a word less and not a word more. Any word less means a republic without Islam, or an Islam without a republic. That does not make sense. Imam said that there should be an Islamic Republic. This means the authority of Islam and the authority of people, which are interconnected and which are not contradictory in any way. The governance of Islam means that values and orientations are determined by Islam. The authority of the people means that the way the government is managed is decided by the people. This is what the authority of Islam and of the people mean. The people's willpower is influential, so are Islamic rules. Imam considered this a problem-solving phenomenon, and the truth of the matter is that it can solve all the problems of the country. Whenever we enlisted the help of the people and whenever we acted according to Islam, we made a step forward. That was the case during the time of Imam, and it has also been the case since his demise until today. I can say this confidently, and this can be supported by numerous pieces of evidence in front of everyone's eyes. Whenever we involved the people, and whenever we made Islam the standard and the main criterion, we moved forward. However, whenever one of these two pillars became shaky, we screeched to a halt.
You've done.
around the world with reporters.
Pakistan's president, foreign minister, and others joined this rally in support of the people of Kashmir. The rallies were held in Pakistan to mark the second anniversary of India's, what Pakistan says, illegal move to revoke the special status of the disputed Kashmir region. India, on August 5, 2019, abrogated the Article 370 of the Indian Constitution that granted special status to the Jammu and Kashmir region. Pakistan rejected the move as a violation of the UN Security Council resolutions that seek a referendum to decide the final status of Jammu and Kashmir.
I want to assure my Kashmiri brothers that Pakistan will continue to support the people of Kashmir for their right to self-determination. We will continue to support Kashmiris till they get freedom.
Separately, Kashmiri leaders also took to the streets in Islamabad. The All Parties Hurriyat Conference staged a protest not far from the Indian High Commission in Islamabad.
We, the Kashmiris, not only in occupied Kashmir, Azad Kashmir, or in Pakistan, but over the world, where the Kashmiris are present, they are making this day as a black day. Why we are making this day as a black day? Because against the will and wish of the people of the Kashmir, India has abrogated its articles.
Protesters condemned the Indian policy towards Kashmir and vowed to continue their struggle until Kashmiris get their right to self-determination.
Kashmir is a disputed territory as per the United Nations resolutions. The resolutions have been passed and at the behest of the India. It was India who took the Kashmir dispute to the United Nations. And it is India, it is the then Prime Minister of India, Jawaharlal Nehru, who in his communique to Pakistan said, we do not believe in forced marriages, and Kashmiris will be given right to self-determination.
Kashmir remains at the heart of tensions between India and Pakistan. The dispute dates back to the partition of the subcontinent in 1947. Both countries have fought wars over the only Muslim majority state controlled by India.
Tensions between India and Pakistan have further deepened since India revoked the special status of Kashmir. Pakistan insists India has to reverse the changes for any talks. India, however, is defending the changes, calling it as its internal matter, and hence the deadlock. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
The brutal battle between Taliban and government forces has intensified recently, with each side struggling to gain more area under their control. Top military officials in southern Helmand province have urged the residents of the city of Lashkargah to evacuate their houses. Reports say Afghan forces are planning to launch a heavy attack on Taliban inside the city of Lashkargah, who use residences of locals as human shields.
We had announced that if a single Talib arrives in Lashkargah city, he will be killed. Even if 1,000 of them arrive, we will kill them all. This fight is not ours. They are Takfiris and slaves of Punjabis. They aren't Afghans. Our fight against them is a pure jihad, and we will continue this holy jihad with a strong will.
Taliban has in recent weeks launched more attacks on provincial capitals, mainly in southern and western Afghanistan. This comes as many here believe neither the government nor the Taliban will achieve their goals to take full control of the country via insisting on further war. They say negotiation is the only solution to resolve the conflicts.
Today, the ancient city of Herat is under attack, and the war has reached inside people's houses in Lashkargah of Helmand. Meanwhile, violence is spreading across the northern Taliban city and other areas. We still hope to reach peace through responsible moves by the government and Taliban.
Based on official figures, over 1,000 Taliban militants have lost their lives in a series of attacks carried out by Afghan air and ground forces backed by local armed fronts since last week. Afghan forces increased their attacks on Taliban militants and liberated some of lost areas, including Nijrab and Talao Barfak districts in northern and northeastern Afghanistan. Afghan President Ashraf Ghani recently called on the entire nation to establish a united national resistance front against the Taliban. He argues that since the Taliban have put military victory on the top of its priorities list, the time has come to talk to militants with guns and resistance. Sayed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
British Muslim advocacy group CAGE is preparing to go to war with the British government after announcing a legal bid against Education Minister Gavin Williamson over what they call discriminatory guidance to school leaders on Palestine. CAGE say the letter issued by Williamson on May the 28th amounted to a disgraceful censorship of political dissent in schools and discriminated against students by infringing their rights to freedom of expression.
CAGE has seen nearly 50 cases of people, of students, who have been targeted in their schools for speaking openly about Palestine and defending the rights of the Palestinian people to defend themselves against a system of apartheid and oppression and occupation.
The government's crackdown on Palestine solidarity in UK schools occurred during the huge global outrage over Israel's relentless attacks against worshippers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque and civilians in Gaza last May. Williamson's letter warned teachers to remain impartial on the conflict, but also warned of concerning rise in anti-Semitic incidents. However, CAGE believe this is censorship cloaked by bogus accusations of anti-Semitism.
It is definitely becoming more of the case that speaking on the issue of Palestine, advocating for the rights of the Palestinian people, exposing the crimes of the Israeli apartheid regime, these are becoming increasingly issues which are criminalized, issues which are securitized, dealt with very punitive measures, whether in schools, whether in the public spaces, or the debate about it is completely hounded out of the public space, such that these issues are silenced and they are unheard.
CAGE are confident of success, as they believe that the government's position on this topic won't hold water if confronted in the courts. And many people are hoping for success here, as the way things are going now, many critics claim and fear that it could become essentially illegal to support the Palestinian cause publicly in the not-too-distant future, unless court battles like this are won now. Robert Carter, London.
Thousands of Lebanese commemorated the first anniversary of the catastrophic explosion which rocked Beirut. Accountability and justice was the main demand of the families of the martyrs.
August 4 should turn into a historic day by holding criminals accountable. The criminals who brought the ammonium nitrate to the port, they killed our children. I lost my only son because of their corruption.
I lost my brother in the blast and lost my mother only 2 months later. She died because of her grief for her son. I want justice for the sake of my brother and my mother. We want justice and we want to see everyone connected with the crime being put on trial.
On August 4th, 2020, a stockpile of ammonium nitrate fertilizer, which was stored without prudence, exploded, becoming one of the largest non-nuclear blasts in modern history, leaving over 200 people killed and thousands injured. The state of mourning for those who fell on the Beirut port explosion is still well alive in the hearts and minds of the Lebanese people, yet justice for the victims still seems out of sight. Yet mourning rallies quickly turned violent after some protesters tried to break into the parliament building. Security forces fired water cannon and tear gas at stone-throwing protesters. Several people were injured. In parallel with the protests, a virtual conference was held in support of Lebanon, where Lebanese President Michel Aoun said the quest for truth and full justice is still the main claim of every Lebanese.
I have already committed before the Lebanese